For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so we're in James chapter 3, and let's just take a look at the paragraph we're going to study. He says, "Who among you is wise and understanding? Let him show by his good behavior deeds done in the gentleness of wisdom. If you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not what comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, and demonic. For where there is jealousy and selfish ambition, there's disorder in every evil thing. But the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace." And so, okay, this is about wisdom. And like James has done in every paragraph that we've studied, he just gets right down to the practical. He's not saying, "Now tell me about your faith." He's saying, "Show me your faith." He's not saying, "Hear the word." He's saying, "Do the word." And tonight, when he's talking about wisdom, he's not saying, "Show us how wise you are by, you know, what you believe and how you can communicate and stuff like that," but let him show by the way he lives. So there's that connection again between wisdom and behavior. And the fact is that you can tell a lot about what a person understands in a deep and personal way about God by observing their life. And so here it is in terms of the wisdom that guides us, that is also evident by how we live. And it's just important for us to understand a couple things about wisdom. He says, "Who among you is wise and understanding?" Wisdom is not quite the same thing as knowledge. Knowledge is important. It's important to know things. It's important to know things about God. It's important to understand how to study your Bible. Things like that matter to the life of faith and to the cultivation of wisdom too. But wisdom is not the same thing as knowledge. Wisdom is a quality that one can develop that's irrespective of your intelligence, your IQ, what you know, things like that. It's a much more subtle kind of thing, and I want to spend a little bit of time just thinking about this because James presumes his readers understand this. And so we who are kind of removed from that kind of Jewish anchor that his audience had, we need to understand it a little bit. Wisdom is a perspective that's formed in the heart, a perspective, an attitude, an outlook. You know, knowledge would be the ability to look out in the starry heavens and be able to say how many stars are out there. You know, we can measure it, and there are things that we can know. Wisdom would be more like the question of, well, what do these things mean? How do we connect the dots so that the world that we live in makes sense to us, that we can live in it in a victorious way? That's what the wise person does. It's practical understanding of the significance of things. And it's something that really comes out of the heart. And it presumes a certain kind of spiritual softness. I love the way the Proverbs describe wisdom. We're going to look at a handful of passages from the Proverbs because it just gets us right to the heart of what this is about. Proverbs 8 says, "Does not wisdom call and understanding lift up her voice?" See how wisdom is personified there. It's not just some abstract thing. It's like a person who's calling out. And he says, "Blessed is the one who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at my doorstep." And so here's just this idea that if our hearts are really soft to the things of God, that he is speaking. He's speaking words of wisdom. And he's calling on us, and he says, "How blessed is the one who is able just to set aside the noise of life and listen. And there's a concept that the Bible refers to in the wisdom literature, especially the Old Testament. That's Psalms and Proverbs and Job and Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. It's this idea of the fear of the Lord, which is not this idea that we are afraid of God, but that there's a certain kind of reverence in our heart for him, that God is God, and when he speaks, it really matters. And so there's just that attitude of the heart that says, you know, if God's got something to say, I really want to hear it. That's what the fear of the Lord is. And the Proverbs say that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. And so God has some wisdom that only those really who are soft-hearted towards Him are going to be able to comprehend and grasp and really put into practice in their life. So there's a starting point, he's saying. What does God have to say? That's the real important question. We're going to be talking, James is going to unfold some really important dimensions of life, of practical living, over the course of the next two chapters. Questions relating to how do I resolve personal conflicts. Questions like, how do I deal with my work life? How do I decide about my material possessions? What happens when I suffer? What do I learn from that? Those are really, really important questions. And they're questions that wisdom brings light to bear on. And so the starting point is what does God have to say versus how do I feel about these things? You know, we want to say, well, here's my plan. I hope God's on board with it or whatever. I got my mind made up. I'm going here. Wisdom says, let's step back for a minute and ask ourselves this question. What does God have to say about that? And to seek Him out in this way. And with that kind of softness of heart comes an understanding, and God is able to lead those whose hearts are soft. Well, here's the hard part about gaining wisdom, and that is that we have to be open to correction. There's a humility involved. And the Proverbs say, he who neglects discipline despises himself. Wow, really? But he who listens to reproof acquires understanding. Before honor comes humility. Yeah, that. And so there's this idea that we're not born wise. We're born foolish. We're born self-interested and self-centered and self-serving and every other kind of self. And we just have to learn and subject ourselves to correction about the whole kind of condition of our heart. I feel sure that I've shared this before. Our daughter, her first word was not mama. Sadly, it's Father's Day. It was not dada. It was self. We'd try to feed her, and she'd bap the spoon out of our hand. Self, self. She wanted to do it. Children are not born wise. They're born foolish, and we have to train them to be wise. And some of us have never really quite gotten that lesson. So we may be incredibly brilliant, but foolish. And that's what he's talking about here, is that if we're going to cultivate real wisdom, God has to do a little bit of a work in our heart to kind of prepare the ground for his guidance and for his leading. If we are gaining wisdom from God, it's going to shape the things that we are able to see. And this is, I think, a very important component of it. Here's a contrast here in Proverbs 3 and Proverbs 16. In Proverbs 3, he says, in all your ways acknowledge God, and he will make your path straight. So there's that attitude there that I'm looking to you, God. And as I look to you, you illuminate, because I've just given over to you. I've said, I really want to see you at work. I want you to accomplish your thing in the situations in my life. And as we have that kind of heart attitude toward him, when we're seeking him like that, he says that he will make our path straight. He'll clarify that. On the other hand, in Proverbs 16, verse 25, it says there is a way that seems right, but its end is the way of death. Well, there just seems like there, you know, this all makes sense to be all about me, to be number one in my life, to go for the gusto, to succeed in the terms that our culture lays it out or whatever. But he says, as intuitive as that may seem to you, the way is death, because it's not God's way. And so there's a real contrast here. And it's important that we understand that there is a work in our heart that God seeks to accomplish so that we will be able to experience wisdom in our life and his direction. Very importantly, in Romans chapter 1, Paul puts it like this. He says, they, and that is to say the people who are kind of looking on, scoffing at the gospel, he says, they did not honor him as God, nor give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish hearts were darkened. There's something very important that Paul is saying here, and which is this, that there are intellectual issues that many times spiritual seekers have. You know, we have these questions in our mind about if God's good, then how come there is this evil in the world? And, you know, all kinds of things like that. Those are important questions. Those are appropriate questions, but they're not usually the real questions. And the real questions, the real issues that separate people from God is a spiritual thing. It's an attitude of the heart. It's a lack of softness to God because we sense, well, God is a threat. God's a threat to my own self-rule. And so we come into the contemplation, the thought about God already with a certain amount of negativity, with a certain amount of pushback, with a certain amount of, hey, I don't know, you know, I'm vested in myself, and therefore I want God to stay at his distance from me. And I remember that, having been exposed to Christianity for several years before I became a Christian. I didn't really have significant intellectual objections to Christianity. I wasn't really thinking in intellectual terms in those days even. But one thing I did have is just that ongoing sense, that feel that he wants my heart, and I'm not sure I'm prepared to surrender that. And so for me, for quite a while, several years, it's just like I want to keep everything out there until my world just sort of began to cave in around me. I had a fresh look at those issues. It was really, I had to come to that place and realize, you know, my aversion to Christianity has nothing to do with the intellect. It has everything to do with the condition of my own heart. Maybe some of us here tonight are kind of that way. We've maybe lived for many years in tension with Christianity, with the Bible. We just have this kind of a negative take on it. Maybe there's some things that happened earlier in your life that kind of form those negative associations with you or whatever, but they've been cultivated by your own heart. And maybe now is a point where there's a fresh opportunity for you to begin a dialogue with God, to begin thinking through, even here tonight, you know, God, maybe it does seem reasonable that you are there. And maybe one of the reasons why I'm not seeing you for who you are is not because you haven't revealed yourself, but because I've really closed a blind eye to you. And how about, will you open my eyes to understand and to see what you are really saying to me? I think that's an important place to begin spiritual seeking. It's right there on the level of the heart. The intellectual things, those, again, those matter. But this heart thing also really significantly important. Am I prepared to hear from you, God? If I understand these things to be true, are you willing to commit your heart to the promises of God? Are you willing to trust Christ with your life? Those questions are important. Now, a second little kind of preliminary issue here. What is wisdom? Again, it's not knowledge in the abstract sense. It's practical understanding. And the way that James describes it, it's interesting because it becomes evident from the way of a person's life. You can tell who is wise and who's foolish by how they live, and he brings out two qualities of it here. He says, behavior, deeds done in the gentleness of wisdom, he says. Praotes in the Greek, it means humility, that the mark of a person who knows God and whose understanding of life is being shaped by him is a person who is cultivating humility. Why? Because they're being trained. They're allowing themselves to be corrected. They're allowing God to shape and to mold their values, their grid through which they look at the world and they look at their own lives. It produces a humility that says, I'm interested, Lord, in hearing from you. And my first inclination is not to think in terms of what's in it for me, but how are you revealing yourself? What are you calling me to? That's humility there. And so there is that observation with the wise person. That they're just not, they're not pushy, they're not arrogant, there's a humility about them. And then secondly, that they have what he calls here good behavior. That's a poor translation, kalos. Really, it was translated here good, means beautiful. And so he's saying that, that the wise person demonstrates their wisdom through the beauty of their life. The beauty of their life. There's an attractiveness to the wise person. Biblical wisdom is not like Yoda living for centuries in his cave on some far-off planet in the universe far, far away a long, long time ago. It's the person who, because there's this vital thing going on with God, this kind of willingness to allow you, God, to shape my heart, and so that I become a little bit more like what you're about, that who God is becomes more and more a part of our own character, our own come off, and so there's an attractiveness there. There's that sense of I'm in the presence of someone who's safe. I'm in the presence of someone who has genuine care for me. I'm in the presence of someone who's not into BS, but who has some things to say that really reflect the goodness of God. And so there's just that desire and that draw toward a person who is wise. Because why? Because we see in their life that there is substance there. There's something awesome there. This is what the proverb says. It says, blessed is the one who listens to me. Again, this is wisdom personified, listening to me as wisdom. Blessed is the one who listens to me. He who finds me and finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. He finds life when he finds wisdom. But the one who sins against wisdom injures himself. And all those who hate wisdom love death. Because why? Because they're just left to their own devices to figure it out. And that usually ends badly. And so that's the framework that James is bringing to the table as he's talking to these people about wisdom. Now let's just unroll where he goes with this. He says in verse 14, a contrast. He's going to contrast two kinds of wisdom and the implications that these wisdoms have for the way that we live our life. And so he says, if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. This wisdom is not what comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder and every evil thing. Okay, so here's one kind of wisdom. The wisdom that is not what comes down from above, but is earthly, natural, demonic. Okay, we'll describe this in a little bit more detail here in a second. And he says, and there are implications that if your starting point is the wisdom that is earthly, natural, and is not from God, is demonic, he says, then that's going to create in you an effect that your life, your inner life, will be shaped around bitter jealousy, selfish ambition, arrogance. Selfish ambition, disorder, every evil thing. That sounds pretty bad. Well, that's James's black and white world for you. And then so he's going to contrast that. Again, verse 17, he says, but the wisdom from above is first pure and then peaceful, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy, and the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So here's a different kind of wisdom. The wisdom from above. And that's the wisdom that we've been describing from the Proverbs. It's wisdom that is oriented in the person of God. And this also then has its implications in terms of how it shapes the lives of people who are driven, whose life is illuminated by this kind of understanding. So let's just kind of bring it together here and to kind of come to our aid. I've given us a little graphic here. Two sources of wisdom: worldly wisdom, spiritual wisdom. with two different results, the life of the ego and a sort of freeing humility. And James is basically saying, he's laying it out. He's just saying, here are your options, folks. You decide. What kind of person are you interested in being? What kind of wisdom do you seek? And so here's how it works. It's really talking first about a perspective. Again, wisdom is not just knowledge, knowing things, facts, history, science, things like that. Those are very important, but that's not wisdom. Wisdom is a perspective that we bring to those things. It's the question of, why do these things matter? Why are they significant? How do they affect my life? What do I do with these things? Those are the questions that you can never measure in a laboratory or something like that. There are questions that are beyond that. There are bigger questions than that. Those are questions that humans ask about, what do I do with these things? That's perspective. How do you process life? That's really what we're asking here. Everyone's got a grid. Okay, everyone's got a grid. Everyone is looking through a certain kind of lens for how do I deal with the real important parts of life, conflicts that I face in relationship. James is going to talk about that. We're going to get into that next week in chapter 4, verses 1 and 11, introduce some important discussions about interpersonal conflicts and how does wisdom come to bear on that. How do I view the person with whom I'm in conflict? Well, one would be to say, that person is an irritant. I've got limited time and energy. And the best thing for me to do is to rid myself of said irritant. Even if that irritant is my spouse, a close friend, or whatever it might be. Or we might say, no, you know, in conflict, I believe that there's something at stake, something that God wants to teach me, something that is a part of His plan for my life. And so there's that lens that we bring to it. It's very different, you can see. And so it is with our work life. What is the significance of work? How do we process through the demands of work as they compete with our time and energy at home? Or as servants of Christ, as parents, and other things that we're involved with? Well, James is very interested in that question. I'm interested in that question. I sure hope you're interested in that question. And wisdom bears on how do we answer that. And James is going to lay out some principles of wisdom that I think are very helpful. Same thing with wealth. You know, there's a perspective that we could bring to wealth that says, you know, I've earned it, it's mine. And I'm sovereign over my stuff. And the one who has the most toys wins. And, you know, stuff like that. That's one perspective. Another perspective might be that the wealth that I possess is really the possession of God, who owns all things and has just entrusted to me for a while some of His stuff to be the steward of. That's a very different perspective. Suffering. Oh, man, suffering sucks. Nobody likes suffering. You know, to be miserable physically, to be in agony within, you know, what do we do with suffering? Well, we want to make it stop. That's one perspective. I have a right not to feel bad. Or maybe there's a different way of looking at it that says, yeah, suffering is the consequence of living in a world that is broken, a world that God is involved in putting back together and redeeming. And He has allowed me to suffer. Why? So that I can better understand the brokenness of my neighbor. So that I can, as I learn to trust Him in these difficult parts of my own life, I'm opening a window. They can see through my behavior the wisdom that undergirds my life.
And so in that sense, my willingness, my interest in suffering actually is an important part of what God is trying to do through me as a witness to the world. See, that's a very different kind of perspective, isn't it? And so James is just going to break these things down. He's going to touch base with the wisdom that comes from above, and he's going to apply it to each of these kinds of situations. And so what we're doing here is kind of preliminary in that sense. He says that earthly wisdom, the wisdom of the world is earthly versus the wisdom, he says, that comes from above. Earthly wisdom, it's temporal. It's like I've just got a limited amount of time. And during that limited amount of time, you know, I'm going to have to just plug in and get for myself whatever I can. Of course. I mean, if sand is running through the hourglass, then it's important that I get out there and have those experiences and do those things. And I don't really care what's in the way, because if all I have is these 70, 50, 30, 80, however many years it is, however many years it is, and you don't know. And all you have is the now. That is going to have a huge impact on how you view the world around you. The wisdom that from the world is earthly versus the wisdom from above, which is this eternal perspective that says, okay, through God's lens, that He is involved in the affairs of our lives, that the things that He brings us to even now have implications that go beyond this life, beyond ourselves, and indeed even into eternity. So there's a huge shift in perspective from the temporal point of view. Secondly, James says that the wisdom that is not from above is natural. Psychikos is the word in the Greek, and it is just, it's like unspiritual. It would be another way to translate that. It's really drawing attention to the material. And it's basically saying it's wisdom that arises just simply out of an observation of nature. That's what the natural wisdom is, as opposed to a supernatural outlook that says what? It says God is involved, that we live in a supernatural world, that it's not just a matter of cause and effect. We can't say I'm just, you know, this way, or this is just the way it is, or whatever. And we've got some decisions to make. Is God active? Because if we calculate our lives and our perspective from the question, is God involved? Then we are going to yield very different conclusions about how we deal with these important parts of our life. Whereas if we're calculating more or less as though it's just all up to us, it's just the world that we live in, we just have to do the best we can or whatever, that's going to yield also a very different point of view. What difference does it make that there is a God who is involved in our lives when it comes to the way, to the issues that you face in your life? And that's what James is wanting us to get ourselves considering here. And again, just in a very practical way. So, okay, you've got conflict in your life. You've got people around you that you're not getting along with very well. The natural perspective might be that you're just incompatible. Their psychological profile and yours are different. You just kind of irritate each other like oil and vinegar or whatever. And God's like, well, actually, I'm greater than those differences that separate you. And I am able to be at work, even in this conflicted situation, to better your circumstance, to better your situation, to better your life.
Do you believe that? Do you believe I'm in the mix, or is it all up to you? You decide, because where you land on this thing is going to say everything about the expectations that you have in the breadth of your life, how you live, what you are able to see, how you put things together. Can you look back at your life and it's just a bunch of random events that don't mean anything? That's a very natural point of view. You're here by accident. You're here for a certain number of years based upon biochemistry and circumstances and stuff like that, and then you're gone. What's the point of your life? Well, there is no point. You know, the point of your life is that just like a fungus or anything else, you come into existence, you do whatever you do, your organism demands of you, and then you cease to exist at a certain point. Woohoo! There's life. Or, God is involved in my life. God is active. God is sovereign. The things that come into my life are a part of His provision for me. They are a part of His desire to shape and mold me into the person that He designed me to be. And therefore, I can respond with a certain sort of enthusiasm even about even difficult things in life. Because why? Because God is active. It's a different point of view. It's a different perspective. James says the wisdom that is not from above is earthly, natural, demonic, he says. Demonic. What does that mean? Well, probably what it means is that it kind of is about the lie that drives humans, that drives personalities, that drive people who are able to think about these things away from God. The central lie that more or less affects all of human history comes out of Genesis chapter 3, where the serpent, hence demonic, approaches Eve. And it calls God a liar. He says, you know, about this whole tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know, you're not going to die if you eat from it. That's just crazy talk. That's just God trying to suppress you. He's trying to deprive you of something that is good. There's a wisdom to be had. And he wants to keep that from you. And she's like, oh, man, yeah. And so, you know, the rest of human history is kind of an outplaying of that reality. Okay, so here's the thing. There is a fundamental contention in the universe. Is God good? Is God's will for your life a good will? Are the things that God allows to come into your life, even difficult or painful things, is that from the hand of a good God? Are these things that even if painful can bring out in us gratitude? Because why? Because they come from or are allowed by the hand of a good God. And see, these three things, the temporal versus the eternal, whether or not God is active in the circumstances of our life, and whether God is a good God, these three questions that James is bringing to our attention are the key issues of will I cultivate real, life-changing, life-giving, satisfying wisdom, a perspective that will enable me to meet whatever challenges with hope, with confidence, with a sense of victory, that give life to the people around me? Or will I be destroyed by them? And those are the two pathways that James is painting for us, you see? Two kinds of wisdom. One that starts from self, one that comes from above. Now, let's apply these things. James says, okay, here, that's the perspective. Those are our options.
Now let's apply them. See, because the perspective that comes from the world, the earthly, the natural, the demonic, you know, these are so intuitive. It's what the world around us is about. You don't have to do anything to get this perspective. All you have to do is not resist the thinking, the thought forms of our culture, because those things are all rooted right within it. To have the wisdom of God from above, the supernatural outlook, the idea of trusting a good God, these are things that you have to actively engage. You have to actively pursue. Passivity is a problem. See, and this really is the difference between a person who has knowledge and a person who has wisdom. A person who has knowledge knows that God is good if they understand their faith as a Christian. They know that God is good. They know that God is sovereign. But they don't know how the goodness and sovereignty of God relate in a practical way to their life. And so they live just like everybody else. Boy, all the studies show that this is the case, too. When people, they study the American church, the Roper organization, and all these other polling agencies and stuff like that, they study the attitudes, the buying habits, the aspirations, the way of living of people in our culture. Why? Well, because they want to learn what does it mean to advertise to them. So there's a bottom line there. It's part of the wisdom of the world. But they're really astute in showing in books like I read recently one called The Day America Told the Truth, which is this advertising guy who just did a very broad study of what Americans really think and value. And consistently these things show that there is almost no measurable difference, no measurable difference between the attitudes about marriage, career, family, wealth, things like that within the Christian community as outside the Christian community. It's just it's a fact, my friends. It's a fact. Why is that? Well, it is because we, as a kind of a composite, are knowledgeable but unwise. To become wise means that we have to actively engage with God. We actively have to seek Him with that open heart, that willingness to be instructed, the willingness to be corrected as He speaks to us through His Word, through prayer, things like that. That means that we have to have a little bit of time available to be active in our pursuit of Him. But most of us don't have active habits in the spiritual life. And because of the lack of that active seeking of God, we're passive about these things and we end up being just like the world around us. And that's why less and less is the influence of the believing church in America on the broader culture in which we live. It's not just that the world is getting darker and darker, it's that we are becoming more and more like it. How about you? How about you? You need to think about that. Let's talk about the implications then. James points out that if we start from this perspective that the world presents to us, it will result in a life that can be characterized by jealousy, selfish ambition, and arrogance. What does it mean? Well, jealousy is just this idea of not being content with what you have. And, you know, are we finding ourselves fussing about what we could have, kind of preoccupied by the things that we could have? How do we feel about other people's success or their possessions or their abilities? I mean, honestly, when you see someone at work advancing, how do you feel about that? Is the first thing that comes into your head, oh man, that was a mistake. I know this, and this thing about that person that makes me better than them. Eh? Envious of their abilities, perhaps? I have to admit to you, I struggle with envy in this way. I grew up in a family that's just, I'm the numbskull of my family. And I just sort of orient myself, learn how to orient my life toward comparisons that are negative in this way. And that's what jealousy and that's what envy are. You see in people things that you would like to have in yourself. You sense that you don't, and so you're competitive or you're contemptuous. You write them off or whatever it is. That's what jealousy is really all about. You want their stuff. Someone invites you over to their house and, you know, you're like, hey, look at that television. Look at that stereo system. You know, this kind of thing. I know you're not like that. But some people are jealous. And it's a perspective that they're bringing. They lack contentment with what they have, and so they must have other things that other people possess. Selfish ambition is a concern for how things advance your interests versus a selfless concern for the interests of others. You know, that's really the way of the world, isn't it? It's looking out for number one. It's choosing relationships that are going to advance my cause. Choosing people who are going to build me up. Choosing directions that are pleasing to me. Well, there's nothing inherently wrong with that, if that's all it is. There is this grain of self-interest and self-ambition and propping yourself up that is driving your thing, then you're not going to find that selfless concern for other people. You're just not going to find the time to really roll up your sleeves and give your life away to people who are not going to be able to love you back, perhaps. Hence the coldness of our culture. It's a cold culture. People come from around the world and they come here and they see just how alienated people are from each other. Why are we alienated? It's not just because of this value of individualism. Of course, that's a part of it. But the big part of it is that we're self-interested. And how many people who are self-interested can find themselves comfortably rotating in orbit around somebody else's universe? Alan Bloom, the author, former author, he's dead now, wrote a book called The Closing of the American Mind. He makes it this point like this and sums up this idea of selfish ambition. He says, here's the problem I see. He says, today, most people love themselves the most. Okay, follow me? That's not hard. And they want other people to love them more than they love themselves. He says, making relationships work is like trying to square the circle. Because that's the world that we live in. And are we selfishly ambitious? How would we know? I mean, do we find in our lives an ongoing and deepening sense of real interest in the concerns of other people, people from whom we can really not benefit much at all, just to present ourselves as servants? Arrogance. Now, I had the burden of having to think about this all week. And so I'm just going to draw you into my burden. Do you find yourself unable to admit your faults? Do you even know what your faults are? Unteachable. Yeah, I got it all figured out. I don't need to hear from you. Critical. Critical. Dismissive. We write people off. We write off the things that people say. Ungrateful. Do we have just that disposition in our hearts that we, you know, we're not thankful. We don't recognize things around us that God in His mercy have given to us because He loves us, because He's interested in our development. We're ungrateful. We hold grudges. All right. That is really painful. Are you a wise person? Well, I don't know. Are you able to identify and admit your faults? When's the last time you approached somebody and said, "Hey, I was really out of it. I am so full of myself in this area of my life. And I want to apologize to you, because it must be a real drag to be around somebody like me." See? An arrogant person can't do that. An arrogant person is unteachable. They're not the kind of person that you can sit down and lay out some things maybe out of God's word, something a concern that you have for them. Maybe you've observed their life and you know, you've got some insight for them, a little revelation. And they're like, "Not interested. Yeah. I disagree," you know, or whatever. And just that, well, it's just arrogant to not be soft toward people who are trying to move toward you with concern and with compassion and with interest in your life. And so to the extent that kind of describes you, you've got a problem with arrogance that is rooted in the perspective that you bring to an understanding of yourself. That's what James is saying. Now, on a more positive note, do you gross yourself out sometimes? Pretty positive, huh? I think this would be a good test of your self-awareness. I find myself sometimes, because I have people in my life who will play back to me the things that I say. They love me enough to be put through the buzzsaw of my retaliation. And they'll be like, "You know, did you realize what you said, you know, to your daughter? Do you realize what you said to your friend," or whatever? And I think that it is, for me at least, it's a measure of my own health and my own movement in the direction of wisdom that I can find myself fairly regularly coming to that place where I'm really grossed out with myself. I'm like, I see the arrogance and I see the whole jealousy thing and that self-ambition, and I just, That's healthy. That's because why? Because that's really in our twisted and broken little hearts, that's the kind of people we are, apart from the grace of God. And it's when we are able to recognize that, then, that we are able to seek out the wisdom that's from above, which James says is pure and peaceable and gentle and reasonable, merciful, steadfast, and not hypocritical. So let's just end with some thoughts here. How about being people whose behavior, whose outlook, whose life is kind of characterized and shaped by humility? That's the key marker, he said, of what wisdom is. A gentleness, you know, an approachability, a generosity of spirit. That's what a gentle person is. Are you a generous spirit in the lives of the people around you? Steadfast. It means that you're not just radically up, radically down, but there's a consistency about your life. A love for the truth. That's what purity is. A love of what's good. Not hypocritical in the sense that you say one thing and you're really about something different. A sanity. Reasonable. You're measured in your speech. And so when you say something, there's a sanity about it, a sensibility about it. That's what a wise person is. And shaped by grace, which is what it means to be merciful, because God's merciful. And peacemaking rather than contentious, rather than being constantly unresolved in conflict, moving away from people because you can't resolve things with them. That's what God's about. See, the central message of the Bible is that we've got a problem with God. See, we have gone our own way. We've adopted this outlook that we've been describing here. And we have become the arrogant, self-possessed person that James describes. And that's a problem with a God who is our creator and who's created us to relate to him. And we've gone our own way. We've done our own thing. But the good news is that in his mercy, not because we deserve it, but in his mercy, God has moved towards us. He's taken upon himself in the person of Christ the burden and the weight of all of your guilt and mine. He's offering us totally forgiveness. Not okay, just be good now, but total forgiveness for all of the things that are offensive to him. That's what grace is. I accept you on the basis of the gift of my son, not because of anything that you do. That's the gospel. That's good news. If you're here tonight, you've not heard that message before. That's what the Christian message is. It's not about cleaning up your act. It's not about making resolutions. It's not about being better. It's about being forgiven. And that's something that God offers you and that you can take him up on even here tonight and just say, I do. I'm interested in forgiveness. I sense my guilt and I want to be forgiven. Will you apply this death on the cross that paid for sin to my situation, God? You see, and he is just very interested in saying, oh yes, that's exactly my plan for you. But see, a person who understands grace is able to cultivate a wisdom and they're dealing with people. They understand deeply how forgiven they are. And so it becomes very easy to extend that same grace, that same mercy to other people. If you're finding yourself disconnected with people because you have judged them as unworthy, you have determined that they are of limited value to your agenda, you've basically said they're too complicated and it takes too much work to really love them, then what we need to understand is that all of those things are true of ourselves before God. We are real high maintenance from his point of view. Okay? And yet he loves us and continues to move towards us. And a person who understands that is able to do that with other people. That's wisdom. And that just works out in our character. It characterizes who we are and how we connect with people. And so I just ask you, you know, let's think about our relationships in which we could develop some of these qualities right here. I think we'd be way ahead if we really listened to James on these points. And do you have a longing to bring God's wisdom to bear in your life? Because if you do, God is eager to grant you that wisdom. He really wants you to become the person who sees things from his perspective and whose life is shaped by a perspective that really gives life. So there's James. Now we're going to just talk, that's the concept stuff. Over the next 3 weeks, we are going to break this, 4 weeks really, we're going to break this down in just the very concrete places in life that we find ourselves as we work through chapter 4 and halfway through chapter 5 in the book of James.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.